Good evening, everyone. My name's Martin Loughlin. It's my pleasure to welcome you this evening on behalf of the Law Department, of which I'm presently head, to this meeting, which is being held in tribute to John Griffith, who, as we know, died this May. John was not only a student of law at the LSE, student from 1937 to 1940, but he also served on the academic staff from 1948 to his retirement as professor of public law in 1984. And I can't utter those words, 1948 and 1984, without thinking in Orwellian terms, but let that pass. It's wonderful to see so many people here this evening and to welcome you all as family, friends, former colleagues, critics, sparring partners, students, or simply admirers from a distance of John Griffith. The fact that there are so many here this evening, quarter of a century after his retirement, I think is indicative of the depth of affection that many of us felt for John. Anyway, we have organized this meeting so that we might hear speeches from a broad range of people that cover the whole range of John's work, life, and interests. I'm afraid there are quite a number of speakers this evening, so I hope you are well supplied with food and wine. At this count, I have 10, and they've all promised faithfully not to speak for more than 5 minutes, and I will hold them to it. We'll see. The first speaker this evening is Michael Zender. Michael's one of our, as I'm sure everyone knows, one of our distinguished emeritus professors. Michael was a colleague of John's for over 20 years, but I suppose more importantly and more to the point on this occasion, Michael was convener of the Law Department at the moment of John's retirement in 1984. At that time, we organized a party to say goodbye and thank you to John on the occasion of his retirement, but John at that stage was absolutely adamant that there could not be tributes presented on this occasion. Well, John's no longer with us, so I don't think his views any longer hold the trump card. And so I'd like to ask Michael to dust off those notes and say a few words of what he wanted to say in 1984, but John didn't allow him to do so. Michael.
Thank you, Martin. It's interesting because I think, actually, the event to which Martin refers was John's 80th birthday. I was the convener then. I was actually also the convener when he retired many years before. But anyway, we had a boat party going down the Thames because John refused absolutely to countenance anything with speeches. It was a very agreeable boat party with much food and drink, but we couldn't say anything to John about him and what we felt about him. So I'm delighted that Martin has organized this event following his fine obituary in The Guardian. And I'm delighted that there will be so many contributions. At this occasion, I think of John not just as a towering figure in the law department, but as the quintessential LSE person. Feisty, eloquent, controversial, scholarly, engaged. Ralph Dahrendorf, in his history of the LSE, memorably described John as the conscience of the school and guardian of its tradition in critical times. His was an independent and free spirit, and with it, though deeply serious, he always seemed to have a twinkle about him. He was the person in the school I was most likely to ask advice. On one crucial occasion, when I was momentarily considering a move elsewhere, he helped me to decide to stay at the school, advice for which I was always grateful, a decision I never regretted. The area of his work that I came to know best was his writing on the judiciary, and especially, of course, The Politics of the Judiciary, first published in 1977, which I described at the time in The Guardian as an instant classic. At the time, I was one of those campaigning for the incorporation of the European Convention on Human Rights into UK law. John was strongly opposed to the idea of any form of UK Bill of Rights. Over those years, he and I debated the issue publicly on a number of occasions. I was unable to persuade him that giving English judges the power to interpret and apply the broad, open-textured phrases of the Convention would be a valuable addition to the civil libertarians' arsenal of weapons. Whilst regretting his stance and finding his position puzzling, I admired the obstinacy of his faith in the democratic process. I believe we will hear later from Mike Post of the role John played in the battle for preservation of Marlowe's famous suspension bridge. In the letter that he wrote to The Guardian after John's death, he suggested that the bridge represented a wonderful memorial to John. We do not have any physical monument that we can link to John Griffith, but his invigorating spirit lives, and I fancy will always live at the LSE. He was a remarkable man. It was a privilege to have been his colleague. Martin, as you know, I asked John's very old friend, Norman Dawson of NYU, whether he would like to participate indirectly in this event, and he sent me some words which I want to read. Their friendship went back to 1956, so it was 55-odd years. What explains the special place John had in the lives of people from diverse parts of the community? His politics were important, but I do not mean only his opinion on this or that domestic or international issue. It included also the way he conveyed his ideas, the forthrightness, the energy, the courage, and the humanity. Above all, he knew in a deep way who he was and from where his beliefs sprung. They were tightly bound in his DNA. John was a spicy fellow, as one of my new NYU colleagues once said. It was part of his charm. This was evident during the frequent visits my wife and I made to Marlowe and latterly to Somerset. And John gave us the pleasure of welcoming him at our house in a rural part of Connecticut. While he was there, he enjoyed haymaking from the fading autumn grass on our lawn. This was an appropriate activity for him because throughout his long and wonderful life, John made so much hay for so many people.
Thank you very much indeed, Michael. Next, Carol Harlow, who... Technology is beyond me. If anyone at the back can't hear, I suggest they come closer. As I say to my students when they sit in the back of the room, can't hear, well, come closer. Carol also was a long-standing colleague of John's, another, I have to use the word again, distinguished emeritus professor. More specifically, Carol is a successor to John in the chair of public law.
Martin asked me to say something about John and public law, but I don't want to say anything heavy about his contribution to public law, partly because Martin has said it so well in his Guardian obituary, but mostly because John wouldn't have liked it, any more than he wanted a festschrift, which had to be sneaked out as a collection of essays by his friends, any more than he wanted the 80th or 90th birthday celebration that Cyril and I tried to arrange for him at the LSE, and which someone has just said he would probably have enjoyed. But John's contribution to public law was significant, especially, I think, in the coalface work that he published on local government and delegated legislation. But John spoke deprecatingly of most of his work, including what he liked to call his little book on the judges. John influenced me in many ways, as he did many people, and he taught me to write concisely and precisely. I remember giving him a very long article, the standard work on separation of powers, and it came back with one word, rubbish. And he also taught me to work at ground level and never on cloud nine. But John eschewed leadership, and once saying, "I'm the last person to attempt to give this thing called leadership. I don't believe in it." To me, as to Michael, John epitomised the values of a particular type of old-style LSE academic. He was deeply loyal to the institution, where he spent all but a handful of years of his long working life, yet at the same time, he was highly critical of the institution he loved. He was a man of great integrity, who retained his independence and fought strenuously for the causes in which he believed, particularly academic freedom. He called himself a Labour Party person and all that, who was not interested in the common law, but just naturally interested in law and politics together, and that's what I shall remember. He demonstrated his interest in the lectures he organised for the Public Law One course, which would in these days of evaluation and bite-sized learning, which I may say John deprecated, be thought very idiosyncratic, because John simply invited his many friends, politicians, practicing lawyers and academics, to give students their ideas of public law and describe the jobs that they did. The result was necessarily random, but also fascinating. Much the same can be said of his editorship of Public Law, a post that he held for many years. John was never an editor who pushed his views onto contributors or attempted censorship, as the wide variety of the contents of those years amply demonstrates. John had no protégés. John loved poetry, literature and theatre, bringing it constantly into his own colourful work. And I remember him reading Auden to an astonished group of first year undergraduates in a tutorial class. John also loved a joke, and when he retired, public law was never so much fun again. In the course of an interview recorded in 1989 as a contribution to the history of the school commissioned for our centenary celebrations, Richard Rawlings, who's here, asked John to express his feelings towards the school that was so much part of his life, and I would like to sign off by simply quoting his reply in his own words, which epitomises the John that I knew and worked with. He says that he spent most of his life at the school and goes on, "So really, the whole of my academic time has been at the school. And when one has been in an institution this length of time, really one ought not to continue to be there unless one has a very considerable feeling of respect for the, and also affection for the institution. I certainly have had that very strongly. It's like politics. It's a bit of a rough old trade at LSE because there are a lot of people there and a lot of prima donnas around. And I suppose some people might even say that I acted as a prima donna from time to time, and maybe they're right. It's a great mixture of people, on the whole of very high ability, working in a sort of general area which is cognate, or being in the social sciences. And one of the great strengths of the school is the common room, and the fact that a lot of people go into the common room and mix in the common room. in my own field of work in public law, if I wanted to find out anything about, say, public finance, public administration, something to do with sociology, whatever it might be, I knew that I could find out within that institution the person who was either the expert on that particular thing or at least one of the top three or four experts in the whole country. This gives the institution an enormous internal strength, I believe. On the other hand, the students have always been, I think, by far the greatest inspiration. I don't know if that's too sentimental a word. The fact is that the students who come to LSE are on the whole very, very good students. They are very competent people. They wouldn't have got to LSE unless they were pretty intelligent characters. You have them for 3 years as undergraduates, and the great joy, I think, of being a university teacher is that you can see how they can develop over those 3 years. You mustn't claim much credit for it, because they're going to develop between the ages of 18 and 21 anyway. But at least you can see the way in which they do develop. And when students get sometimes very discontented with the institution, and I suppose all of them do from time to time, and quite rightly, because they come with expectations which are probably too high for any institution to cover. But I used to say to students that when they've graduated and have gone out to the world, someone will come up to them, maybe in the next year or the next 10 years or 20 years later, and say, "Where did you go to university? Where did you graduate from?" And the student will look them in the eye and say, "I was at LSE." He won't shuffle about and say, "Well, actually, I was at," and mention some other place. In other words, people are proud of having been at LSE, and I personally also am very proud of having been at the place. I think that as educational institutions go, it's vital, lively, intelligent, and so are the students. And this vitality of the institution is absolutely essential to its welfare and well-being. And for that reason, I'm very grateful to have been there. End of the recording.
Distinguished emeritus professors of law at the LSE come in threes. The third one, unfortunately, could not be with us. Bill Wedderburn was invited to come and say a few words, but, well, I'm just going to read out. He wanted me to read out what he has written. Bill, that is Lord Wedderburn of Charlton. Unhappily, a catastrophic rearrangement of unavoidable medical appointments for tests overnight makes it impossible for me to attend the meeting in honour of John Griffith, so that sadly I will not be able to take up your kind invitation to be one of the speakers. Among other things, I would have wanted to make clear what a tremendous privilege it was to be in the same university department as John, and how right was my decision to leave another place, that he says Cambridge, and accept the kind invitation to a chair at the LSE in 1964. John, as a colleague, was a major reason and a massive addition to my own education in terms both of scholarship, learning, and ideology, more than I could have expected or hoped. His death robbed British legal scholarship of one of its brightest stars and humane teachers. Please read this message for the meeting with my deepest apologies as an inadequate tribute, which sadly I must offer in my absence. That's from Bill. And now for something quite different. Our next speaker is Tom Bauer, a former student of John's, scourge of any magnet. I've lost the list of the biographies of Robert Maxwell, Conrad Black, Richard Branson, and Survivor.
Good evening. I'm terribly proud to be here tonight. I'm here because I love John. He was a wonderful teacher, and standing here today, what I remember of John is his laughter. He had that wonderful gift of laughing at society, at the situation, and even at himself. And at the same time, he had that terrific gift which was so inspiring, that when he hit a point in law or in politics or society, and in the Great Revolution, in which I was very proud to play a tiny part, and a few more people here today played a bigger part, is when he focused his eyes, when his eyes clenched together, and he was making a point which you knew was critical. And his genius was that he could explain the most complicated points in the most simple manner. Because essentially, the greatness of John was he was a great teacher. He loved his students. He not only loved the brightest students, but he loved the no-hopers. I once said to him, "John, why do you keep on disappearing with this fellow? I'm sure he's not here tonight, called Guy. He's always going into the pub with Guy." And he said, "Well, I feel sorry for him. I'm trying to encourage him." And that was the marvellous thing about John. There was no pretense. There was no performance. There was just principle. And in that principle, what he taught me, and for which I am very grateful, and why I have been able to make some people's lives very miserable, is that he was a terrific exposer of deceit, of the flaws, of the fraud of power. Because at heart, John was really a social revolutionary. He was a great professor of law. He understood the law probably better than most, but he understood the weaknesses of the law and of its practitioners. And it is that part of his teaching which I took away from this place. That I arrived here confused about society, looking for some explanation, and John provided it. Because he, in his analysis of the courts and of the judges and of society, was able to explain to teenagers who arrived with a modicum of education how to analyse what was wrong in society and who was responsible. And in that glorious moment when we thought that we were taking over the world by occupying this building, there were many, many people who ran for it. And I remember, because I met John quite a lot in the days after, and I was always fascinated that John stayed in this building when it was under the student occupation, when many left. There might have been other reasons than just pure revolutionary zeal. But there was one notable absentee, and that was Ralph Miliband. And he was the great Marxist professor who should have been leading the vanguard and was noticeable by his absence. And I said to John, that it was actually lunch at the Garrick, that just shows how revolutionaries become part of the establishment. And I said to John, "What happened to Ralph?" And he hummed and hawed and he said, "Well, the trouble was that Ralph was worried about his pension." And that's the thing about John. He also was risking his pension. But his great courage, his integrity, his standing meant that no one would dare, despite whatever he did encouraging the students to fester their ridiculous revolt, he never was fearful of losing his pension because nobody would dare stand up to his integrity. And that was because he was a man of terrific courage. And I can only say what a pleasure it has been to speak to you today and how lucky we are to have known him. Thank you very much.
We're very pleased this evening that some members of John's family have been able to join us. As many will know, John met his wife Barbara as fellow undergraduate students here in the late 1930s. Barbara happily survives him, but is unable to be here this evening. But I'm now going to ask, and John has one daughter, Sarah, and two sons. I'm going to ask Adam, who is going to go first as the eldest son, to say a few words. We've heard quite a bit this evening about Marlowe and John's, and allusions to John's legendary at-homes during Marlowe Regatta week, so it's only fair to be comprehensive to invite someone from the Marlowe group to come and address us, and Mike Post has kindly agreed to say a few words. Over to you, Mike.
Thank you. John, as you all now know, lived in Marlow in Buckinghamshire on the Thames for over 50 years. And what all you may not know is that Marlow owe him an incalculable debt. For those of you who do not know Marlow, its finest building is our Grade 1 listed suspension bridge over the Thames. This was completed by William Tierney Clark in 1832, and it served as a model for Tierney Clark's famous but much larger chain bridge over the Danube linking Buda and Pest in Hungary. Not only is Marlow Bridge very beautiful, but it serves two important functions which are essential to the nature and character of Marlow. It restricts the heavy traffic. It has a 3-ton limit, so only cars and light vans can go over it and up the high street. It also has narrow arches at either end, so that only one car can pass at a time. So what this means is that Marlow Bridge prevents Marlow and its fragile network of roads getting swamped by heavy traffic. From 1955 to 61, John represented Marlow on the Buckinghamshire District Council. As a councillor, he became aware that the Vandals, who were the Buckinghamshire and Berkshire highway engineers, were hatching a plan to demolish our beautiful bridge and replace it with a concrete bridge of either 2 or 4 carriageways. I'm not sure that ever was really established. As soon as John became aware of this as a councillor, he sprang into action. He gathered the great and good of Marlow together, and they formed the Marlow Bridge Preservation Society. And from what I've been hearing tonight about John's character in academia, well, it's all of one, because he is a fighter, and he fought and led this group of people for 5 years. And in 1961, the bridge vandals withdrew, Marlow Bridge was saved, and about 10 years later, a new bridge was built over the Thames for the Marlow bypass, and Marlow retained the bridge and its character. Had John not acted as he had done in the 1950s, Marlow would not be the place it is today. It would be profoundly different. There would be no beautiful suspension bridge, and the high street and the road network would be blighted by heavy traffic. And I doubt whether people such as myself, my wife and our family, and other people who are here today from Marlow, would have actually moved to live in Marlow, because it would have been just another town with a high street that was had traffic thundering up and down it. I first connected with John a few years later, in 1993, at a public meeting held to consider the building of a Tesco store in the heart of Marlow, on the site of the newly demolished Weathered Brewery. It was apparent that the district council at the time were in favour of the new Tesco, which was, I mean, it was massive. It was like the one in Amersham, if you were aware of it. Massive thing with 600-place car park round it, right in the heart of our conservation area. It became apparent to us at this meeting that the Marlow Society, which was the direct descendant of the Marlow Bridge Preservation Society, the executive was wavering and defeatist. And we were extremely worried, and a group of us who had met at this meeting, we got together at a pub a couple of days later, and we formed what we called the Marlow Group, and we decided we were going to change the position. Without the blessing of the Marlow Society executive, we arranged for a poll of all the members, and we established that well over 90% didn't want this Tesco, which is, we weren't being told that, we were told exactly the reverse. Once we'd held the poll, the society reversed its position, we won the district council round, they changed, and we were spared Tesco dominating our high street. After that first success, under John's leadership, the Marlow Group took action in a timely manner to defend Marlow against unwelcome developments whenever we felt it to be necessary. Our last significant action was in 2006 to defend Marlow against a very large, inappropriately sized Waitrose superstore. This was planned to be built in the heart of Marlow's Georgian conservation area. The development, crucially, depended on the district council buying for Waitrose use, by compulsory purchase, land owned by the local family of undertakers. Inspired by John, we called a parish meeting using a little known provision of the 1972 Local Government Act. At the parish meeting, we demanded a parish poll, and these are very useful things if you ever need to use them, because only 10 people at the meeting can call a parish poll, and it has to be held. And it's still there. They should actually change the law, but anyway, that's another thing. Anyway, the poll was held on a beautiful day, June the 6th, 2006, and there wasn't a cloud in the sky. We were only allowed one polling station, but we had queues waiting to vote, well over 100 yards long, snaking outside this local primary school. It was absolutely wonderful. And because we were lucky with the weather, and we had an overwhelming result. And we established that the compulsory purchase of this land was not in the overwhelming public interest. Because I'm sure, as all the academic lawyers here will know, that the test of whether, or a test of whether compulsory purchase is a good thing, is it in the overwhelming public interest? Well, the people of Marlow had voted that it wasn't. So we had a very strong card to play there. It's truly wonderful having an emeritus professor of public law as your leader. Waitrose lost. On a personal level, John was a great and kind friend who could always be relied upon to give good, sympathetic advice. He once gave me great comfort when a powerful public figure in another area completely wrote me a very scary letter accusing me, quite wrongly, of defaming him. John reassured me that I was correct. I hadn't defamed him, and I was nervous for a few weeks, but nothing happened. Meetings of the Marlow Group, chaired by John, were an education in the need to think and express oneself as clearly as possible. I often felt personally like a nervous and unprepared student attending a tutorial. John was intolerant of fools, foolish words, hypocrisy, pomposity, and bad wine. My family and I called him the prof. He once remarked to me with a twinkle in his eye that it was hard work being a member of the awkward squad, but it was an indescribable pleasure to be stimulated by his fine mind, to be inspired by his total integrity, and not least to be associated with the matchless prose which graced the Marlow Group submissions, which of course he wrote. Finally, Marlow, its people, and all those who love Marlow owe John a great debt. The enduring presence of Marlow Bridge is his memorial. And for those of you who might not know Marlow, there's our beautiful bridge, which John saved.
As I look around the room, I realise there are as many people, if not more, who have already spoken, who will be desperate to get up here to say a few words, but I don't think we can afford that luxury if we're going to be true to John and to have a drink after these formal proceedings. So perhaps I should finally call on John's other son, Ben, finally to say a few words. Ben.
Naturally, I love Dad, and I loved having him as my dad. We always knew that his work was central to his life. I never understood how it was possible to draft and redraft time again on the typescripts that Colleen prepared, or how Dad could finish a meal without stinting on wine and then go back to his desk. When the family went on holiday, his first concern was packing his battered briefcase with the documents that he needed to keep sane. And then he'd be up early every morning working at the kitchen table while we were still sleeping off the night before. So I was a bit in awe of him. In Marlow, his desk was at the far end of the sitting room. And as a young boy, when I had something to ask him, my mum had to push me into the room. But he was always happy to be disturbed. We knew that really we came first. Dad cared so much about Mum and about his children and later about his grandchildren. Always ready, indeed keen, to get into scraps on our behalf and to lend comfort. Although, to be honest, his carefully considered letters could be a bit difficult to follow. And Mum's always seemed a bit more to the point. For a child, Dad was probably best in person. His advice was so reassuring and calming and sensible, and his love was so total. Of course, he was very keen to help us develop intellectually. We had long discussions about law and politics and religion at evening meals or when walking the dog in Marlow Common. And Dad would always want to look over our written work and suggest changes or suggest that we start again. He was hardly ever angry with us. My bedroom was above his desk and I would disturb him playing music. So he came upstairs and he pointed out that my Beatles were conflicting with his third programme and perhaps we could take turns. As other people have said, Dad was often down when his writing wasn't going well or he was dispirited about one of his battles, which he often went on to win, or about politics and especially about war. When he was in his 60s or his 70s, I complained to Mum that he was always going on about death. Mum said, "John's been going on about death since he was 20. But he was so funny and so charming when he was in a good mood. He was a great storyteller, especially about his time in the army or about the troubles at LSE. He loved to play the hand trumpet and sing along to Billie Holiday and George Melly. And of course, I preferred the pop songs that he used to sing along to. "You Must Have Been a Beautiful Baby" and "Living Doll" and "Bobby's Girl." Those were the greats. But above all, he loved clear and beautiful writing and to read it out loud to us, Shakespeare, Auden, Larkin. He said he wasn't sure how much of the Bible was true, but there were such good stories that I think it was mostly the language that he loved in the King James Version. So for all the reasons set out tonight, I am immensely proud to be Dad's son. As for Dad, I dreamt about this event the other night. I was in my parents' house with Adam, and we were saying it was a shame that Mum wasn't up to making it. And then I said, "But what about Dad? It is about him. Wouldn't he like to come?" And he was sitting in the corner and looked up. He looked pretty chuffed. So thanks very much to Martin for organising this and to all the other speakers, and thanks all of you for coming.
I'm sure we have plenty more to talk about. Thank you so much for coming along this evening. There's still drink, and there's so please fill your glasses. And one last toast to John Griffith. John Griffith. Thank you.